Hi, I'm Lindsay Roundtree, and this is the MadTech Podcast, the fast and furious news for the MadTech generation. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. It's Lindsay Roundtree hosting today. You'll be surprised to hear it's been Rachel for so long now, but she is off having a nice relaxing time away for the week. So it's me, a little out of practice in hosting. And joining me today is the wonderful CEO of ExchangeWire, Kieran O'Kane. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Lindsay.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, mate. Good to see you back in the hot seat there.
It's a strange feeling.
It is.
Yeah, I've got first day nerves. It's fine, it's all good. And I'm delighted to welcome our special guest today, who is Tom Ollerton, founder of Automated Creative. And also, you may well know him as the host of the podcast Showing New Objects, as well as host of the webcast, I guess, Advertisers Watching Ads, which our very own Rachel Smith featured on recently, butchering, frankly, critiquing the latest Nike ad. So welcome, Tom. Great to have you here.
It's brilliant to be here. I've done loads of podcasts and very few have actually been interviewed. So this is a real treat. I'm really excited. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Another podcast crossover. We love those. So I will get straight into our first news story. And as like we mentioned last week, we've switched the format up. So we're sticking to 10 minutes. And once 10 minutes is up, I'm going to shut everybody off. So starting the timer now, our first story is the news that Walmart fortifies its ad platform with omnichannel analytics offering. So Walmart's media division, Walmart Media Group, has launched its first omnichannel reporting solution that is available at scale. Performance dashboards provide brands with how display and sponsored products are performing, both in-store and online. And that's what I find interesting here personally, is the fact that you can actually, it's the omnichannel aspect. You can measure in-store and online advertising in one place on one dashboard. I've got quite a few questions about this. I guess first and foremost, we talk a lot about walled gardens, and we will definitely get to that later on the podcast as well. In adding to their self-serve ad platform, do you think this is the next step for Walmart towing themselves and building their own walled garden? Tom, I will come to you first with your thoughts on this.
Yeah, lots of different thoughts about this. And I'm sure, yes, they want to build their walled garden. And I also agree with you that the in-store and out-of-store tracking piece that is their sort of defensible point against Amazon. But I would love to know how they're creating any kind of relationship between that online and offline sales. Surely that's like this attribution nightmare from hell. And I think a lot of conjecture and pie charts will follow, and it'll need some really skilled analysts to make sense of that, because it looks like a nice dashboard, lots of graphs and lots of data around how many sales, how frequent, how often, click-through rate, ROAS, all the rest of it. But what it really misses is why those ads are working. It doesn't really talk about the content as far as I can see. It doesn't talk about copy or visuals or length of ads or the gender of the people in the ad, for example. So it does look quite fancy, but in one respect, it's not really telling the huge part of the story, which is what is in those ads, just whether those ads are working or not.
Very interesting points there. And actually, I mean, so obviously this is a platform that is currently in beta that they're working with some of their big partners on. I would expect that there's a lot to do. And the point of the beta is that the brands they work with will come up with the tell them what it is needs to be added to the platform. Kieran, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, if they've built an analytics platform, they're looking to obviously to sort of big up their performance aspect. Right, so it's a performance play for me. How much money do you spend on Walmart, and what's the success metrics against it like? So, I'm not surprised they've done it. Walmart is sort of Amazon's, closest competition probably in that sort of online commerce space. And I think the one thing that Walmart has that Amazon doesn't have is that offline data point. So the ability to kind of like to match the two types of data. So, here's an ad on our website and here is the sort of after effects, the sales. I think it's a brilliant idea, but it goes back to Tom's point, is that it's a big ask to put all that data together. It's the modeling piece to be interesting. But if I'm an advertiser, I mean, look, an advertiser is going to ask, well, if I spend $1 billion, I need to know what's happening to that money, So some kind of, because we've talked about this before, right? with the deprecation of third-party cookies, the most important piece for display advertising, specifically display advertising, is the measurement piece, right? If you don't have a persistent ID across all these different channels, it's very hard to measure the efficacy of display advertising. And I guess Walmart saying, well, we have a massive fuck-off walled garden. We want to be able to show the advertisers that if you spend X amount of money, you're going to get Y back in return, right? And it's a performance play. First and foremost, Walmart's saying, like, we're a transactional platform, right? We sell Crunchy Nut Cornflakes and nappies, right? We're not, like, trying to improve brand awareness and lift, you know, get brand lift. We're about, at the end of the day, it's transactional. It's about how many bloody, you know, packs of cornflakes have you sold? How many nappies have you sold? So this is a really important layer that they're building into this. So I think it's a good thing from Walmart's perspective. And I guess you'll probably see something similar to some of these companies in Europe, you know, Carrefour in France and a few others like that, that will look at this and say, I think what Walmart's going to be is a template for any large-scale offline, you know, store, box store retailer that has is growing its e-commerce opportunity. So yeah, I mean, it's a natural step, smart, but again, like, it's Walmart telling you this. Like, there's no independent layer. It's Walmart saying this is what's happening. It's kind of like I'm marking my own homework again, and that's a problem, right? The Facebooks, the Googles, the Amazon are marking their own homework, and I think that would become that might be an issue for some brands.
But I mean, if everybody else is doing it, why shouldn't Walmart? And I think that there's an interesting point, and it ties in with the point you made, Tom, about the you know, what analytics are you able to actually look at? What insight can I get from this platform, from this dashboard? And brands and retailers notoriously have a very fractious relationship where, you know, brands will give retailers money and retailers will use that money and not tell them where they used it, how they used it, and what returns that gave the brand in terms of sales of their products. So you would think that this would be one way of being able to kind of mitigate that and bring that relationship more transparency. Tom, do you think that that is a possibility? Do you think that, you know, to Kieran's point, that Walmart is going down maybe a dangerous route in kind of doing the marketing your own homework thing? Or do you think this will actually help build stronger bonds between brands and retailers? They have historically been quite fractious.
Well, I think it depends how accurately they mark that homework. You know, if it's just like you sold some stuff, then yeah, sure, it's a bit dubious. But I think that the main thing that is going on here, it's just a Me Too thing. It's not like, oh my God, I've never seen a dashboard before, or oh, what, data based on clicks? It's nothing new, really. I mean, I agree with Kieran, it's a smart move that they're doing this. But if I was working on the sales team at Walmart, you have to be going to clients saying, this is what makes us different, right? Otherwise, they're just going to go, well, we'll just stick with Amazon, whatever. And so it has to be, what is the relationship between offline and online that they can actually tell? So that what they need to do is not be Amazon. That has to be their play here. How do we give you better data based on better accuracy or more transparency or the combination between online and off sales? And this is how we are not Amazon, because the other play that Amazon's got, which is going to be super tough for these guys, is their kind of weird top of the funnel thing, which is the Amazon Prime content, right? So you go to Amazon to watch TV or film or whatever it is. And like Walmart, like so far off that, as far as I can tell, that they're in there, as Kieran said, like this is selling nappies and Crunchy Nut Cornflakes. You know, whereas Amazon are building up that lovely, fluffy relationship at the top of funnel all around the content that they make. And so when people pop over to watch whatever show it is, yeah, they might also buy some cornflakes. So I think they've got a hell of a fight on their hands here.
Why would you buy cornflakes when you have Crunchy Nut Cornflakes?
Well, do they sell Crunchy Nut Cornflakes in Walmart in the States? I don't know. There's maybe two details.
Is Crunchy Nut Cornflakes just a European phenomenon?
I don't know. If it's full of sugar, they'll sell it.
It's probably something really sugary and called something radically different.
I'm looking it up now.
Probably a head.
But I think the data play is something that's interesting here. And kind of in our final couple of minutes, like Tom, you mentioned Amazon and what Amazon's doing top of the funnel to try and get customers in. And they've obviously recently announced that if you are an Amazon Prime customer, you will now get Amazon Fresh, which is their grocery delivery service, for free. You just have to pay delivery, which, you know, as an Amazon Prime customer who has used Amazon Fresh for the first time during lockdown, like, it's actually a really, really smart move. Do you think that where Walmart will struggle, being a more traditional grocery retailer versus the likes of Amazon is that is the customer acquisition piece and how they actually tie that data in together and really, really give an omni-channel perspective. Kieran, very quickly.
Yes, just briefly, the answer to that question. I think it's a smart move. I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think that this, you know, the data piece is a missing link for them, right? They've done a great job of building up the e-commerce. They already have putting through quite a lot of money in that platform, right? So they want to build out the big ad business and show that this is actually working. Then they need that analytics piece, and that's the most important. I just think it's smart. I just think that the walled gardens have a trajectory, right? They build out the scale, and then they have to prove to the marketers that this is actually working. For me, it's a logical move for them. Is it good for the buyers? Who knows, man? But it's, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of those buyers look for scale and return on investment, and that's what Walmart are trying out.
The big news is here that Kellogg's Crunchy Nut cereal $3.22 on Walmart.com, but it's sold out.
Very good.
There you go. Yeah.
That seems expensive for Crunchy Nut cornflakes. How much? I don't eat cereal. How much does cereal cost?
I mean, I get those big boxes. You know,
boxes.
And you can the way you kind of like pack them, it looks like a sort of a corn silo. It's deliberately done that way, so it's like I can't describe the shape. What is it? It's sort of like a. It's like a rectangle shape with a triangle at the top, and you tie it. Anyway, there's a science to preserving the quality of your cereal.
I see. On that note, I'm moving on. I'm done. I'm done with cereal science now. Next story. So this story is about marketers experimenting with TV ads in console video games. So a story in the WSJ about how marketers are inserting TV ads into games played on consoles as an attempt to reach younger audiences who are watching less and less TV. As we know, as we're probably aware, ads in console games are not a new thing. You're probably used to seeing them on like ads in street billboards and racing games and around arenas and stadiums and sports games. So far, it looks like these are being run via Simul Media on EA Games, their first test partner, on a wrestling game. And what I must point out is that these 15 or 30 second ads are optional rewarded video ads. So very much like what you're used to seeing more commonly in mobile games. And they are kind of nichely targeted. So an example that was given was an Experian ad running in this UFC 3 game, I think was the name of the UFC game. And it's narrated by John Cena, who is a wrestler. So it's trying to target these audiences as something relevant, but something that they're trying to get across in a different way for these people that aren't watching TV. Now, there's probably a few things to unpick here. But first of all, I want to kind of get your perspectives on, you know, we know as players, we're used to watching rewarded video ads on mobile social platforms. But do you reckon they'll be tolerated in a console, particularly from the more hardcore gamers, particularly when those gamers have already made a significant outlay on the console and then the game itself? Do you think this is a step too far in game monetization? Kira, I'll come to you first.
15 seconds is too long. It's too long.
15 or 30. It's a 30 seconds is way too long.
Oh my God. I'd be fucking livid if I was a gamer. I can only imagine how those people spitting blood and fire out of their nostrils. And I'm not really sure gamers do that, but you know.
But you haven't got to watch them. And if you do watch them, you get rewards. And actually, to be fair, in mobile games, it's the same.
30 seconds is too long. I think
that's the same in mobile games.
Well, I think it's a really stupid format. I mean, I think between 6 and 15 seconds probably is the optimal length. In fact, 6 seconds should be the optimal length for a mobile and gaming situation. I guess the marketers now have finally come to their senses that they cannot ignore the gaming segment anymore. Like, they used to talk about, oh, it's not brand safe, which is hilarious given how much money they put on YouTube and Facebook and all those shitty UGC platforms. And they finally come to their senses. I remember talking to, who's the CEO of Simul Media again?
Dave Morgan?
Yeah, Dave Morgan describing this to me. And I said, well, that's an ad network, which it is an ad network, but it's a very clever ad network. And it's got value, like all good ad networks have value. So, I can't see, if it's done the right way, it'll be fine, because TV advertising is not as annoying as you know, a cluttered page or a slowed down page on a newspaper site. You know, and like all good, like good creative, like particularly TV creative, is you know, is engaging. And John Cena, is it John Cena the wrestler doing it? I mean, that's a good thing. You build ads for the audience, for people to know and respect, then I think it'll work. But you have to respect the user as well. I think 30-second ads done, right? You can do it as much magic in 6 or 15 seconds if you need to, like, you know. So I think this is good. I mean, I'm not really sure from the gamer's perspective what their reaction would be. But as you say, Lindsay, if it's incentivized, then this should be a problem. But at the same time, you should balance the user experience there as well. Don't put 30-second, don't repurpose shitty TV ads and put them in front of people who are not going to engage with. Just think about the audience and build something that's user-friendly. But ultimately, I think it's a good thing.
And I can see, Tom, you're itching to speak here. I'm really interested in your perspective on this, particularly with your creative hat on. What do you think about, do you think this is a step too far, or do you think this could work?
Yeah, I disagree with what Kieran says. And I think the sort of key is in the title, really, isn't it? It's a marketer's experiment with TV ads in console games. You know, don't put a TV ad in a game. Don't put a TV ad anywhere else apart from a video game. And it's a bit like cutting a birthday cake with a baseball bat. You know what I mean? Like, no one's going to thank you for it. I think that to Kieran's point about 15 seconds being optimal, I totally disagree with that. I think there's this misunderstanding in digital that, like, and certainly in social media, that gaming is sort of, depending on the game, that short is best, you know, and that people have got really short attention spans. That's just nonsense, because people watch films for all kinds of hours. It's what's in the content that matters. So a brilliant 30-second spot will engage attention. A terrible 30 spot won't work at all. And I think what the advertisers need to do is be empathetic to the audience. And I think using the John Cena cameo thing is sensible. It feels appropriate to the platform. But, like, obviously a huge part of what we do is testing lots of different creative. We just think it's insane that someone produces an ad and then just wedges it in anywhere, be it gaming, Facebook, Instagram, display, whatever it is. So what brands need to do is to be testing huge amounts of different strategies, copies, and visuals, because the technology is there to do it. Whereas this seems very much like, oh, we found a new ad unit at the start of a game, we're going to wedge it in there and hope we get away with it because it's not too bad. So it's just old advertising wedging itself into new advertising. And I think if you look at something like the Travis Scott gig on Fortnite, I think it was the biggest gig of all time. It was just this kind of giant Travis Scott is like 300 feet high doing a gig with all kinds of like burning microphones and upside down dolphins and stuff. And it was a unique experience. You could not experience that anywhere else in the world, but they took the time and the budget to produce something that was unique to Fortnite and really changed perception of the platform. Whereas, I don't know who these advertisers are. Experian, for God's sake, just wedging in a 30-second ad in the hope that they're just going to get enough eyeballs that someone might click through is the wrong thing to do.
I think
it's frequency.
I think they're incongruous with their surroundings, I think, is ultimately, and Tom, your point about, you know, wedging old advertising into new advertising is exactly it. Like, are we still in a world where advertisers will take a 30-second TV spot and try and cram it in anywhere? I thought we were over that by now, but clearly we aren't.
Oh, it's so easy, though, isn't it? Well, we've got this ad, we've got a rectangle somewhere, let's wedge it in. I mean, you might as well have punted it, but I don't think it's going to work.
But I mean, there's also the argument about rewarded video in general, and there's long been people that have been up in arms about rewarded video in general, because they're claiming that you're forcing someone to watch an ad. You're literally tying them to their chair, making them watch an ad, and that's not a way to engage people. It's a view that I personally disagree with. I think rewarded video is great, but do you think that there's merit to that view, that actually this should not be the way to monetize? This shouldn't be the way to actually get somebody to engage with your ad, is to give them reward for watching it.
Depends how good the ad is. that's the thing. Like, is that ad optimized? Is that ad changing based on what people are interacting with? Is that ad developing based on the view through rate? Is that ad developing on the click through rate? Is the copy changing? Is the tone of voice changing? Is the visual changing? Then if so, yes, you start off with your best guess and then you optimize from there using a balance of machine and human intelligence, right? That is the future of the way advertising works. If we just look at it as like earn ads and reward, it's the wrong way. Like, how are you doing the best possible deal for the people looking at that ad? Yes, the reward's part of it, but how are you as an advertiser making sure that that ad is a brilliant bit of content in and of itself, irrespective of where it's being served?
Kieran, do you think that it's right for games publishers to be monetizing console games in this way, given that they're already taking money from gamers anyway for the game in the first place?
It depends on what the context is. I mean, if it's to get to another level, if it's incentivized, then I don't see any problems with it, because the user has enough. Like, the thing is, I have no problem with incentivized advertising. Advertising is incentivized, right? Doesn't matter where, like, TV advertising is incentivized. So you watch the program and the ads are in between, right? You go to a cinema, you watch ads before the fucking cinema, right? The main show. You know, I don't have any, this holding them down view about, advertising should be incentivized is nonsense. Tom says, as long as the ad is great, most people don't really care, right? Because in many respects, the ad could be just as entertaining as the bloody film that you're watching, you know? In fact, in many cases, it is, if it's done the right way. So I don't see any problem. But going back to whether or not the console maker should make money off ads, it depends on what context, right? If I've paid for the console, right, and I've paid for the game, I don't want to see any ads, right? Unless they're blended into the actual game itself. Like, if I'm driving around in my car in a Grand Theft Auto, right, and I see a massive billboard with a game, but it's part of the game, I don't really mind that, right? What I do mind about, if I'm trying to get to the next island or whatever it is in Grand Theft Auto, or the next sort of city,
10 seconds.
I don't want to see a 30-second ad. I'd be absolutely livid. I'd be pissed off. So you have, this is where I'm, you know, wedging ads in for the sake of ads is wrong. It's just wrong, and it actually destroys probably the KPIs of the brand itself, right? If they're now inserting themselves into a game playing, that there's going to be a negative view of that brand, right? And all of their hard work has gone out the window. But if it's done in a cool way, where I'm driving around the city, right, and the GTA car radio is playing me an ad, and it's done in conjunction with a brand, that's cool. That is a cool thing. That's context. That's got value, right?
And on that excellent point, I'm going to stop you because minutes are up. You've gone over, but it's all right. I'll allow it. You were on a good roll. So, final story is still on the gaming theme. And this is that Apple is blocking Microsoft xCloud and Google Stadia on its App Store because it says it can't control the game content. So basically it says it has no control over the games on those two platforms respectively. So those platforms would be available in the App Store, but then the games themselves can't be reviewed or controlled by Apple. And each game that would appear on the respective platforms would need to be submitted to Apple before review before they can appear. This would obviously be on top of the 30% cut that Apple demands from any in-app revenue generated. And let's not forget that Apple has its own game streaming platform in the form of Arcade. This is probably less about this story, but more about it. It's more talking about kind of Apple's dominance. And actually, is Apple becoming too much of a force to be reckoned with? You know, we talk about GAFA a lot, so Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple. And actually, Apple doesn't get maybe as much stick as the likes of Google and especially Facebook get from particularly Mr. Kieran O'Kane here. But actually, should we be taking a closer look at what Apple are doing and how their dominance? And do you think that this, you know, this is less this story in isolation, but do you think that Apple is becoming increasingly anti-competitive? Kieran, I want to start with your views on this.
Yes. Yes, they're the sneakiest of all the gaffer, right? The sneaky gaffer, right? So they pretend to be all about users and the product, and they have a CEO who speaks in folksy southern lilt, telling us all about the product and talking about privacy. It's utter bullshit. Utter bullshit. Apple is basically taking a 30% toll charge over its platform, right? And it's all wrapped up in the fact it's a an Apple only thing. But like they use that platform, right, to launch their own products. So music's a good example, right? Spotify have to give 30% of their revenue away to Apple, right? Apple launched an Apple Music thing and they suddenly have a competitive advantage. Oh, for the fact is they can push their own product on their own platform and they can charge less, right? That's anti-competitive. So that's one aspect of it. They've recently got rid of IDFA, which is basically an identifier on their device now, in the name of privacy. But there's accusations this week and actually proof that Apple is basically allowing its own SCAD network functionality to access IDFA so they can do measurement and targeting, all the rest of it. And it's building its own ad business, right? I did a post a couple of months ago, arguing that Apple is going to build a very significant business. It's just easy margin. I'll come back to the gaming piece, but those platforms favor their own products, right? There's a reason why it's blocked Microsoft and Facebook and even Google's solution, because it's competitive to their own, right? That is the fucking reason here. And it's very obvious. Now, the good thing about all this is that the recent sort of hearings has highlighted the fact that these platforms are too big and too unwieldy. And obviously now they're eating each other. But Apple is, for me, one of the sneakiest of the four, right? Because the rest of them are obvious what they're doing, right? They're using their monopolistic powers to build up their own businesses, right? So whether it's in their own vertical or horizontal, they use it to eat up other verticals. Apple are no different. In fact, they're probably worse because they say they're doing it for the good of privacy. They say they're doing it for the good of users. It's utter nonsense. They are massively anti-competitive and they have to grow revenue, right? And that is one way. Gaming is a hot spot, Lindsay, as we know. It's a mass growth area. And for them, why would they let 2, 3, 4 of their biggest competitors get into the hen house and take all of the potential upside for them, you know?
Totally agree. And I guess the question I've got for you, Tom, is if you think that actually Kieran just mentioned, you know, Apple says it's doing this for its consumers to keep them safe, basically. Do you think actually in a roundabout way, Apple's actually hurting its consumers by ultimately giving them lack of choice and killing off any chance of competition by making sure that everything that you do with an Apple product is within this closed ecosystem? Actually, do you think that it's ultimately hurting the economy and hurting consumers by not allowing them to make their own choices? It's all being done for them.
Well, I think they can make their own choice when it comes around to getting the new phone, if they can move operating system, I guess. I know that different phone suppliers that's where all the growth is, right? Is to steal share from their competitors. And I completely agree. I love the PR spin of, are we just doing it for our consumers, which I'm sure they are to a degree, but absolutely Kieran's nailed it entirely. But the only thing I would add is, and this shows some of my ignorance, is that the way that any of these platforms are going to win it is by making their own games and their own content, in the same way that, you know, Amazon or Netflix produce their own content. Like, you can only get it there. So ultimately, the way that anyone will switch between Microsoft or Google or Apple will generally be around a phone choice or an operating system choice. Whereas actually one mega move might be to start producing games that you can only get on these platforms. That would be a much more defensive move than this kind of tit for tat. Oh, well, you can't sell our stuff on here, because then they'll just do it to them and backwards and forwards. But I'm not the person to ask about whether it's good or bad for the economy. But ultimately, it's down to who's going to provide the best service for the people who want to play these games.
And I guess from a gaming perspective, actually, what you just highlighted there, Tom, is kind of what's sort of been done in the console wars for years. Actually, there's been a lot of competition in terms of you've got some games that are exclusively available on either the Xbox or the PlayStation, and others that are available across everything. Actually, is this just a regeneration of that in a kind of more modern day environment, Kieran? Or is it as you say, just and it's just Apple trying to make sure that they are bringing Google and Microsoft down?
Yeah, basically, this is the opening salvos, I think, to this bigger fight over the gaming space, right? I think Tom's right. Apple's going to have to invest money in building its own gaming library, you know, or buy an EA Games or buy another company. It just feels really insidious. I can't tell you how upsetting this is to me, because I'm sick of these companies owning big swathes of digital media and digital marketing. It just makes me fucking sick that we live in a society where four companies are sucking the oxygen from the room for the rest of us. Nobody has a chance to innovate when they are deliberately blocking innovation. And I have to say that. I argue that Apple and Google and Amazon and Facebook are killing innovation, and they're killing the economy. They may say that they're doing great for the economy, but they're sucking the money from people. I'm a capitalist, right? Just straight out, I believe in capitalism as a mechanism for the greater good and building great business and equality and the way to make money. But I feel like I'm in this bloody non-end film where four companies have built this in crazy monopoly over us, and we cannot move without one of these fuckers taking money out of our pockets. And I'm sick of it. I mean, the story itself is hilarious, that the three companies or four companies are the biggest companies in the world, like, you know, they're all scrapping over another. I don't want gaming to be owned by Google. I do not want gaming to be owned by Facebook. I don't want gaming to be owned by Amazon or Microsoft or any of these companies. I want it to be open, right, so that there's a chance for a European company or a British company or an Irish company or another American company to come in and build market share with a really good product. But it gets increasingly harder when Apple is slapping 30% of a toll fee, blocking competition on their platform because of some sort of, you know, tenuous excuse. I'm getting to the point now where I'm just getting so frustrated with these companies. Sorry, just
we have this conversation about Amazon quite a lot, and it's very much, you know, retailers, brands don't like working with Amazon, but it's very much better than ever. You know, they know that they will get traction and business from Amazon, so they have to show their products on there. Actually, you know, we've had Fortnite and also the likes of Activision and King have talked about this as well, as in they're no longer going to put their games on the likes of the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store, because they're not happy about paying those ridiculous exorbitant fees that they charge, and they're instead going to actually self-publish and create their own app store. And I think there was one that's created for Fortnite, but it was riddled with concerns about fraud. But obviously, ultimately, like Amazon, it seems like better than you know, because they haven't worked, and they've ultimately had to return to Apple and Google because there seems to be no other option. Is that killing something? Is that making you die inside of it?
Yeah, it makes me sad. But then, why is nobody funding a company that can compete with this? Build a universal platform that allows us to compete with these. I think there's also this. I think a lot of people have just been beaten down, right? It's like, you know, there's been no breakout success stories. Was that the phone? 8, 7 seconds. No breakout success stories in the last sort of decade. And I think that's frustrating a lot of people. And I think that's probably what we're at the minute. So, I'll go have a cry after the show, I think.
And Tom, I mentioned that Kieran was very passionate about this, and you got to see it firsthand.
It's not the first time I've listened to Kieran give it both barrels on this podcast, I have to say. So it's interesting to be nearby.
Definitely. Right, so we're at the end of our three news stories, so we will come swiftly onto our kind of chat with you, Tom, about what you're up to. So first of all, for those that don't know, it'd be great to have a brief intro into what automated creative is. I guess it sort of does what it says on the tin to a certain degree, but let us know what it is that you're focusing on at the moment with automated creative.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the platform to talk about the business. We set it up about 3 years ago, and at that time I was an innovation director at an agency, and I was coming across all these different AIs that could write copy, write music, run media campaigns, research audiences, do things like deep fakes and create fake images and stuff. And all these technologies were very much in their infancy, but I thought at some point all these things are going to come together and there will be this new advertising or creative service that was powered by AI. And I thought, well, instead of trying to drag the agency along with me, I thought I should just go out and build that. And so a couple of us set it up, and we've been going ever since. And essentially where we are at the minute, we haven't completely revolutionized advertising yet, but we use AI-driven creative combined with social and search insight to optimize the way that social and display ads perform. But crucially, the big thing to us is we're able to tell brands why their ads work A lot of suppliers in the space will tell brands which ads work, but we can actually dig down on a quite deep level and tell brands like what are the different strategies, visuals, messaging, language, for language styles and formats that work. And we're lucky to work with some really big brands. We work with Diageo, Adidas, Reckitt, Unilever, GSK, in all kinds of different markets where I don't speak the language. I think we're live in 30 odd markets. We just be excited about creating a new form of advertising where we're removing the subjectivity of the big creative idea and replacing it with a machine-led type of creative that responds to every single different message in the conversations out there. And what we're working on at the minute is we've just launched a private beta, I think it's called, also known as, not very many people using it at the moment, a tool called Creator, which is a self-serve version of our technology. So brands are able to log into that platform and then generate hundreds of ads in minutes, get them live, and then start pulling their own first-party creative data into why those ads are working.
How do you measure then the success of the campaigns then? If you're not running the campaigns, but how do you know whether or not the ad has been successful based on the tweaks you've made?
That's a brilliant question. So we have the tool that where we upload all of the content to it and then we generate the ads from that tool automatically. But our tool is able to understand what's in all of those ads, right? So if it's like indoors or outdoors, or it's male, it's female, it's night, it's day, it's this product, it's that product, it's a passionate tone of voice or a passive tone of voice, it's 3 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever it is. And then all of those obviously run through whatever ad server it's going through. And then we can pull back into our dashboards which ads have worked, but also which elements of those ads have worked. And that's based on whatever metric is relevant to that brand. So if someone's, we might optimize the cost of sale, or we might optimize to cost per click or click through rate or view through rate or cost of a download. It's really whatever the brand comes to us and says, this is our metric, we optimize to that. But we deliver the performance, but also the insight at the same time.
And the appetite for brands analyze their creative in this way is what I find interesting, because there's obviously, I often feel like there's good intentions with brands and how they want to understand what creative works. But, like we talked about earlier, a lot of old advertising habits can often kick in, and you give them one ad, you go, brilliant, let's repurpose this into a million different ways. That'll be what we can do for the rest of this campaign. How easy is it to have the conversation with them to say, yes, this will be more work for you, but these are the rewards you'll get off the back of it by understanding exactly how your creative is working for this campaign?
Well, it's not more work for them. So it's exactly the same amount of work for the brand and for the media agency or internal media team. And so we're saying to brands, look, we'll increase the performance of your ad, but we'll also tell you why. So then you can take that first party creative data and feed that into your next creative process, which is what brands like Diageo do on a regular basis with us. So I think the real change and what excites us is that the old model is, agency does some research, agency comes up with a big idea, agency produces that expensive ads, and then they sort of cram that through a DCO to moronically work through all the least worst version of all of those elements. Whereas what we do is we listen to the conversations in social search, and then we create ads for every single one of those things and then optimize from that point. So we're kind of sidestepping the big idea, if you like, and we often generate all of those ads from scratch anyway. So the brand really doesn't change what they do. It's just a different approach to digital advertising.
So do you work with the creative agency, the media agency, or the brand itself?
We employ by the brand, and we create like a fluid link between the creative agency and the media agency, which is like a tech platform that sits in the middle. So instead of the creative agency going, here's our beautiful thing, there you go, media agency, find some eyeballs to stick it in front of. Because we are able to break that creative down or create our own creatives, we're able to create that fluid back and forth between the media clicks are telling us this thing, therefore we need the creative to do this thing, and then we automatically generate that stuff. So we've almost created like a third role in between the creative and media agency.
So like it's a connected tissue from the media agency to the creative agency, which has sort of been missing, because a lot of the time they don't really talk to each other.
No, no, it's completely different. It's almost a left brain, right brain discipline, creative media. Whereas we're like ex-agency guys experimenting with technology. So we bring that creative and strategic sensibility to automated, dynamic, programmatic technology. That's our kind of sweet spot. We deliberately put ourselves in that uncomfortable spot between what is a creative business and a technology business, because there isn't really anyone out there who does it the way that we do it.
Brilliant. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but that was really interesting. And obviously the battle of data-driven creative and the future creative is one that I'm sure you'll be fighting for much longer. And the new creator platform you've built sounds really interesting. So excited to hear more about that as it gets up and running. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom. It's been great to have you.
Hey, I tell you, it's a lot easier being an interviewee than an interviewer. I've massively enjoyed it. That was great. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. You're welcome. And Kieran, thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Tom.
And this has been the Mad Tech Podcast.